Want to get more from Killer Psyche? Subscribe to Wondery Plus for early access to new episodes, ad-free listening, and exclusive content you cannot find anywhere else. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. A listener note, this episode contains adult content and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised. In 1979, the psychological thriller When a Stranger Calls was released in theaters. The first 20 minutes of the film are unbelievably tense and creepy, and it has been labeled, quote, one of the most terrifying movie openings ever. The film revolves around a teenager named Jill, played by a very young Carol Kane, who is babysitting while the parents are out for the evening. Before they leave, the mother tells Jill that the children have been sick and not to wake them. But for Jill, the night is not uneventful for long. She begins to receive disturbing calls from a man asking her if she has, quote, checked the children. At first, she believes it to be a silly prank. But the caller is relentless, and Jill becomes more and more frightened each time the phone rings. She calls the police several times. In the beginning, the detective Jill reaches tells her not to worry about it. It's just a weirdo messing around. But as the night progresses, Jill's fear grows. So the detective tells her to keep the man on the phone the next time he calls, and the phone company will trace it. So when the stranger calls again, Jill attempts to keep him on the phone. Asking what it is that he wants, the caller says, quote, I want your blood all over me. Understandably unnerved, Jill lets it slip that she has called the police, and the man hangs up. The phone immediately rings again. This time it is the police to tell her that they have traced the call, and it is coming from inside the house. I will not spoil the rest of it for you, but needless to say, portions of the film are terrifying. Of course, as with most movies, you need to have the willing suspension of disbelief. In 1979, there was no tracing a call after only a minute. If they were able to trace it, it would have taken at least 10 to 20 minutes. However, the idea that evil is right under your nose, or rather in the same house, not only makes for a good movie, but is also a reality for some people. When 16-year-old Becky Watts went missing, search teams made up of volunteers, police, family, and friends scoured the landscape all around the city of Bristol and its neighboring towns looking for her. But they were looking in the wrong place. Becky had been tormented and killed in her house, in her own room, where she was supposed to be safe. And while her loved ones looked everywhere, the two villains that murdered her were right under their nose. Her stepbrother, Nathan Matthews, and his girlfriend, Shauna Hoare. We get support from Audible. There's more to imagine when you listen. And the Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere. With Michael Connelly's audio drama, The Safe Man, you will be transported to a riveting detective story, nail-biting heist thriller, and supernatural mystery. All of that in one story. It's about a man named Brian who is hired to open a rare antique safe. And of course, it unleashes something sinister. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible for free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. That's audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. Killer Psyche is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Wondery and Treefort Media, I'm Candace DeLong, and this is the third season of Killer Psyche. I was a psychiatric nurse and then an FBI criminal profiler. In the 5 decades I've spent studying people's minds, I've interviewed countless murderers, including many serial killers. Why did they do it? To get a satisfying answer, we have to dive deep into their psyche to figure out what made them do what they did. This episode is Nathan Matthews. On the morning of Thursday, February 19, 2015, Darren Watts left his home in St. George, Bristol, and went to work. Darren's wife, Angie, was slowly getting ready for a doctor's appointment her mother was driving her to later that morning. Angie had been suffering from MS for the last 4 years, and the doctor's visits had become a regular occurrence as her symptoms progressed. The Watts were a blended family. Darren had 2 children, Danny, who turned 20 that very day, and 16-year-old Becky from a previous relationship. And Angie, his wife, joined the family with a son from another relationship, 28-year-old Nathan. At 8:30 a.m., an hour after her father left for work, Becky came home from a sleepover. Her key did not work in the door, and Angie had to let her in. After thanking Angie, she went upstairs to her room. Angie's mom arrived at 11:15, and they left for her appointment. An hour and 45 minutes later, Angie arrived back home and was greeted by her son, Nathan, and his girlfriend, Shauna. Shauna often spent the day at the house. She was supposed to be helping Angie with household chores and taking care of any needs she had. But more often than not, instead of being useful, she would play on her phone or watch TV, something that she and Nathan were doing when Angie arrived. When Angie asked if Becky had come downstairs, Shauna said she had heard a door shut an hour ago and believed that it was Becky leaving. When Nathan and Shauna left, Becky still wasn't there, but she was known to decide to spend the night with friends at the last minute, so no one thought there was any cause for alarm. That is, until the next morning, when Becky's boyfriend and friends came over to the house. They expressed how worried they were because they had not seen Becky, and she was not answering any of their calls or texts. That's when Angie realized that something was not right. She quickly called Darren, who left work immediately to begin searching for Becky. Becky's friends looked through her room to see if there was anything missing. They realized that Becky had not taken her usual items with her, her makeup, ID, and wallet. But her phone and laptop were gone, a laptop Becky never took out of her house. Darren called the police. As he waited for them to show up, Darren had his stepson Nathan help him post on social media asking for any information on Becky's whereabouts. When the officers arrived, they did not appear to be too concerned about Becky's absence. After all, Becky was 16, and police believed that this type of behavior was not unusual for a teenager. But Darren and Angie knew better. And as they became more and more frantic, news of her disappearance spread across the town. And a few days later, when Becky still did not come home, the police also became concerned. Their theory was that Becky had run away, and after seeing everyone looking for her, she was scared to come home. If only that were true. Law enforcement launched an online campaign titled #FindBecky, which received over 2 million shares. The entire community of Bristol was determined to find this young woman. People canvassed the woods and the surrounding areas, all searching for Becky. There were no signs of Becky anywhere. Then, on February 28th, the police called in two people of interest for questioning. Those two people, her stepbrother and his girlfriend, Nathan Matthews and Shauna Hoare. The police had found evidence of blood on the doorframe of Becky's room. Although the blood had been cleaned up, crime scene technicians discovered Nathan's fingerprints there as well. When confronted, Nathan confessed, calling it an accident. He told them where he had disposed of Becky's body, which had been dismembered and scattered on his friend's property just a mile from the Watts house. The police also had footage of Nathan and Shauna shopping for electric saws, tape, and other items that were used in the dismemberment. And last but not least were the texts between Nathan and Shauna. They both seemed to share a sexual interest in underage girls and were making jokes and references that police interpreted as being about Becky's murder and dismemberment. Nathan told police that he was just trying to scare Becky into, quote, being a better person. He said that she was leaving items all over the floor, which was dangerous to his mother because of her MS. She could trip over them. Nathan claimed that he was going to disguise himself with a mask, kidnap Becky, take her out to the woods, and threaten her, that it would make her grateful for her life and would convince her to be more considerate. But when he tried to take Becky, she fought back and his mask came off. Panicked, he suffocated her, a crime the prosecution would later describe as a sexually motivated attack. He then hid her in the trunk of his car and without Shauna's knowledge, took her back to his house and dismembered her in his bathtub. Again, all without Shauna knowing anything. The police did not buy it. On March 3rd, police arrested Nathan for murder and Shauna for perverting the course of justice. They also arrested four other friends of the couple for helping them hide and dispose of Becky's body. Soon, Shauna's charges were upgraded to murder. The couple were also charged with conspiracy to kidnap, preventing the lawful burial of a body, and possession of an illegal weapon. In addition, the two were charged with crimes not associated with Becky's death, including four counts of making child pornography. Nathan was hit with additional counts of sexual assault and voyeurism. Nathan continued to swear that Becky's death was an accident, but it was no accident. It was murder. And the prosecution was ready to prove it. If you're captivated by true crime mysteries that remain unsolved for decades, then you won't want to miss Who Killed Jennifer Judd, a new investigative podcast from ID. In May 1992, 20-year-old Jennifer Judd was brutally murdered in her apartment just 9 days after marrying her high school sweetheart. Jennifer had been stabbed multiple times with knives that were just given to her as a wedding gift. Now, 32 years after Jennifer's tragic death, investigator Sarah Kalin is determined to finally solve this cold case. She'll speak with Jennifer's friends and family, piecing together the details of her life and the moments leading up to her murder. Who Killed Jennifer Judd is a captivating true crime podcast that digs deep into this perplexing murder. Listen to Who Killed Jennifer Judd wherever you get your podcast.
There's nothing worse than getting home from your trip only to find out you missed a can't-miss travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator makes it easy to explore over 300,000 travel experiences, everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche interesting stuff in between, so you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who have already been on the experience you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer service means you always have support around the clock. Download the Viator app now to use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Regret less, do more with Viator.
Nathan Charles Matthews was born on January 9, 1987, in Bristol, England. Growing up, Nathan never knew, and still doesn't, the identity of his father. The slot for it is left blank on his birth certificate. Despite being very close with his mother, Angie, Nathan was raised by his grandmother, who lived a mile away from her. Angie was in a horrible relationship and decided that it was safer to have him stay with her mother, although she would still walk him to and from school every day. The message he must have received of having his mother so close and yet not taking care of him must have been confusing. When Nathan was 12 years old, his mother began a relationship with Darren Galsworthy. Darren had two kids, Danny, who was 4 years old at the time, and Becky, who was only two. Danny and Nathan got along really well, but Nathan was not at all fond of little Becky. At the age of two, she had typical toddler meltdowns, which required adult attention. Attention that Nathan thought he should be receiving. Those feelings only intensified when Darren received full-time custody of his kids and they moved into the home with his mother and Darren, while he continued to stay with his grandmother. Once again, Nathan was displaced by his own mother for someone else in her life. That couldn't have gone down well. As Nathan got older, his relationship with Darren evolved into more of a father-son dynamic. Darren taught him to drive and took him for his first beer, and Nathan responded well. Darren would later say that he considered Nathan his own son and encouraged him to join the Army Cadets, which he really enjoyed. Darren would go on to say that back then, Nathan was a much different person. He was working three jobs, going to school, and even had been making more of an effort to get along with Becky. Through his time in the cadets, Nathan began studying to be an electrician and eventually landed an internship with an electrical firm. But when he was 17, that firm closed. And although he was working part-time jobs, he did not look for another full-time position. Nathan was consistently complaining about having pain in his back. When he finally went to the doctor, they diagnosed him with fibromyalgia, which causes certain chemicals in the brain to trigger pain all over the body. Nathan claimed that he had been in constant pain since elementary school, but it was now becoming unmanageable. School friends have since acknowledged that he would often complain of being in pain, and it caused his outlook on life to be bleak. I can understand how constant pain could definitely cause someone to be depressed. It's a fact. Ongoing, unchecked pain can cause depression. When Nathan was 18, he began dating his first girlfriend. The relationship did not last very long due to Nathan's issues with jealousy. When they broke up, Nathan had a hard time letting go. He continued to stalk her until she became so afraid that Nathan's grandmother had to step in and calm the situation down. Although he stopped bothering his ex, his behavior was far from typical. A year later, Nathan showed up at the house with four girls around the age of 12 sitting in his car. When his stepfather questioned him, Nathan claimed that the girls just wanted to, quote, go for a ride. Darren's reaction shocked Nathan. Darren told him to take the girls home because they were children, and it was strange that he would want to hang out with them. After realizing that Darren was not joking, he left and stayed away from the house for a while. His stepsister, Becky, was also having a hard time with social relationships. She was being teased and bullied in school and was miserable. As a result, Becky developed anorexia, which in Nathan's mind was just another bid to get attention. He began taunting her, telling her she was fat. At 23, Nathan was still jealous of his 12-year-old stepsister. Becky would later tell her father that she only felt safe at home, not alone, and not with Nathan. Her father chalked it up to sibling rivalry, but unfortunately, it was not that simple. At the trial, one of Becky's best friends claimed that Nathan would constantly threaten Becky when they were alone, that he would describe in detail the ways that he would torture and kill her. Not only was this sadistic, but it probably fed into his fantasies. And since we know what eventually happened, in a way, I think what he was saying could be looked at as a warning. At the age of 21, Nathan brought his new girlfriend, Shauna Hoare, to meet Darren and his mother. However, she was not welcomed in with open arms. In fact, she was not welcome at all. Darren realized that she could only be 14 years old, and he told Nathan that he would not allow him to do something illegal, especially under his roof. 2 years later, Nathan brought a birth certificate over showing that Shauna was now 16. I hardly know what to say, and that's an unusual place for me to be. Shauna, like Nathan, had not been raised by her parents. She was brought up in the foster care system and did not live with her mother until the age of 13. Although polite to the adults, Shauna was not nice to Becky and did not care to associate with her. Just 1 year later, Nathan's mother, Angie, was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and her symptoms would sometimes leave her unable to walk. This is when Nathan's relationship with Shauna also began to change, and once again, he became jealous in a relationship, an emotion Shauna appeared to enjoy. She would flirt with other men and then not go out with Nathan. This made the problem worse, and he tried hard to control Shauna, even making her pay him for cigarettes, claiming that he was trying to get her to quit. The couple began hanging around Darren and Angie's house, relying on them for food. Nathan stopped working altogether. In fact, he stopped doing many things altogether. He no longer bathed or shaved, and he rarely changed his clothes. That can definitely be seen as a sign of mental decompensation. His anger and resentment towards Becky seemed to grow, and he became more and more aggressive as time went on. Now, mind you, he's not living with his mom and stepdad, so why is he so upset with Becky? Nevertheless, he was. Then Shauna became pregnant. While the family celebrated the news, Becky exclaimed how happy she was to become an aunt. Nathan turned, got in her face, and told her she would never, quote, go anywhere near his baby. After the baby was born, Shauna began caring for Angie. Whenever Nathan was angry, he would take it out on Becky, jumping out from being hidden, grabbing her shoulders, and screaming in her face. It scared her. He claimed that it was done in fun, but we now know that was not true. In the process of researching this story, one thing I realized was glaringly obvious. Nathan's motivation to kill his sister, though definitely driven by jealousy and hate, was also quite possibly sexually motivated. And that officially puts this bizarre murder in the totally creepy category as well. But what makes this story so unique is the fact that they were essentially siblings, almost from the day Rebecca learned to talk. True, they were a decade apart in age, Nathan being 12 years old when she came into his life. He was in early adolescence, a time when most young boys are way too busy and involved in their own lives than to change diapers, feed, teach, watch out for, and otherwise nurture and guide a very young child, a toddler, in fact. Though Nathan mostly saw Becky on weekends, she was involved in his life from the moment they met, if not on much more than an emotional level. I also think it's safe to say his involvement, his personal association with her, was not as close and caring as any other sibling relationship of a young child to an older brother would be. The truth is, he resented her. Resented that she and her older brother Danny got to live with his mother and stepfather, and he did not. And he blamed Becky, not his mother or stepfather, though they were the ones that made that decision. But despite the ill will Nathan felt for her, Becky's very first words were not mama or daddy. It was Nathan. So then, what went wrong? Why did he murder her, and in such a horribly grotesque way? True, siblings argue and sometimes fight physically. Without question, sibling rivalry is alive and well in many, if not most, households, usually to at least a small degree. But sometimes the rivalry is a very slow, intense, and long-lasting flame that never goes out, even when the object of the rivalry is dead. Think about it. Have you ever heard someone you know speak disparagingly about a family member that is dead? And the anger and resentment they display is as intense as if they had just been stabbed in the heart by them? You probably have witnessed that, but what you have not witnessed is one of them being murdered by the other. Why? Because sibling murder, also known as fratricide, is extremely rare. And by rare, I mean less than 2% of all murders are between brothers and sisters. But when it does happen, it is usually done in the heat of passion. It is unplanned and motivated by intense rage, usually resulting from an argument. In an article authored by Dominique Bourget and Pierre Gagné in the Journal of the American Academy of Psychiatry and the Law in December 2006, quote, "Data from coroner's files on domestic homicide pertaining to individuals killed by their siblings over a 10-year period in Quebec, Canada, identified several specific offender and victim characteristics and circumstances surrounding these types of murders. They found that from a forensic psychiatric perspective, they were able to identify several characteristic patterns and potential dynamics operating in the act of fratricide, the murder of one's brother or sister. They also found that most cases of such a crime are impulsive, alcohol-related, and unpredictable until the moment they occur. Although murder within families is certainly not uncommon, it's usually between spouses or a parent and a child, not between siblings. The truth is, there is very little research on fratricide, but what is known is that most of them involve adults rather than adolescents. And according to the FBI's Uniform Crime Report, a review of 510 cases over a 12-year period revealed that males are considerably more likely to be offenders and victims of fratricide, and that 73% of these cases involve brothers. Additionally, less than 10% of victims were younger than 18 years old, and the average age of offenders was about 34 years old. And here's an interesting twist. They found that fratricide offenders are more often younger than their victims. I recall a case of sibling murder when I was an agent in Chicago, in which one brother stabbed the other in the heart with a carving fork. It was a dispute over the last juicy pork chop on the platter. Now, while I don't condone that behavior, I can understand it. Okay, back to Nathan and Becky. Clearly, their case does not fit easily into any of the studies I read, except that the killer was male. Other than that, this murder was unique in the annals of sibling murders. And I think I know why. Nathan may have been motivated to kill his younger sister, Becky, out of jealousy, but there were other motivators as well. Remember the story of the 12-year-old girls in the car and that he started dating Shauna when she was only 14 years old? And let's not forget, he and Shauna had several threesomes with a 16-year-old girl. And who could forget Nathan encouraging Shauna online while she was shopping to, quote, "bring me home a pretty one," referring to young teenage girls. Clearly, Nathan had a fixation. His fantasy girl then, and dating back to when he was a teenager himself, was very young teen girls. Now, it's certainly not unheard of for men to be attracted to younger women. But for the most part, adult men and women prefer and are attracted to age mates. Why? Probably because people of the same age range have a lot in common, especially young people. But in Nathan's case, it was an intense physical as well as emotional attraction. And there's a pretty good explanation for that. Nathan is a psychopath, devoid of empathy for others, incapable of guilt or remorse, shallow in his emotions, self-centered, pleasure-seeking, and incapable of learning from mistakes. And very importantly in this case, emotionally, behaviorally, and intellectually immature compared to non-psychopaths. And many psychopaths have a profound need to control others. So what does this have to do with him being attracted to really young girls? When the founders of the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit were doing their landmark study on compulsive killers, now known as serial killers, they not only studied their crimes, but their personal, familial, and educational backgrounds as well, among many other things. One thing they learned about men who kill girls and women is that in their youth, whether it be grade school, high school, college, or simply being out in the world as a young adult, such as Nathan was when he killed Becky, is that they preferred the company of younger kids to their own age mates. Why? Couple of reasons. First, younger kids looked up to them, as most young kids do around older kids. And being looked up to and admired, even if it's only by little kids, made them feel good. Second, younger kids, having far less experience with life and people, are much easier for the psychopath to control than their own age mates. The budding offender gets the kids to do things with him and for him that they know they should not be doing. As the younger kids get older, they see the offender for what he is, a jerk, and pull away from him. And there are some other reasons I think Nathan is a psychopath, and I'm guessing that if you're a fan of Killer Psyche, you know what I'm going to say. Nathan showed absolutely zero concern, that would be empathy, for the angst and insurmountable suffering his mother and stepfather were going through over the disappearance of 16-year-old Becky, whom Nathan had known since she was only a 2-year-old toddler. He knew how much Darren and his mother loved her, how sick they were over her disappearance, and later, how shocked and sickened they were over the knowledge of what really happened to Becky at the hands of Nathan. And just like a true psychopath who was unable to feel empathy for others, he could not have cared any less than he did over their grief before and after Becky's body was found. Lastly, it was the opinion of the judge at sentencing that there was a sexual component to the crime, though whatever it was not brought out in the trial. The judge would not have said that without reason to believe it, which he no doubt learned from the prosecutor. And that's what I meant when I said Nathan not only resented and was jealous of Becky, but had sexual feelings for her at the same time. I also think Shauna knew that little detail about Nathan, the man she loved, and she hated Becky for it. And what did that mean? It meant Becky had to go. And while I'm on the subject of Shauna, there is no doubt in my mind that she lied to the police when she denied any knowledge of what Nathan had done, including dismembering Becky in the only bathroom in their tiny house. But in the world of criminal investigation and prosecution, it's not what you think. It's all about what you can prove.
People thought it was impossible to build a firm, lifted booty, and flatten and shrink your abs at the same time. But we've cracked the code. I'm Carl, the CEO of Body. That's Body with an I. And if you want to lose weight while you build a firm, round booty and flat, tight abs, even that lower pooch, you need to start the 80-Day Obsession Fitness and Eating Program on Monday. 80 workouts shot in real time. It's like you're training with the cast as they make progress day by day. Crazy booty gains, flat, tight abs. We test it and proved it, and now it's your turn. There's no subscription needed. You can get this in-home program for less than 75 cents a workout and own permanent digital access. But here's the thing. The price is absolutely going up on September 1st. And if you don't see results in your butt and abs in the first 30 days, you get your money back, no questions asked. So get 80-Day Obsession before the price goes up in September. Go to 80dayobsession.com. That's 80dayobsession.com. 80dayobsession.com.
On October 6, 2015, Becky's murder trial began. The trial was a media sensation, and the journalists swarmed the courtroom every day. The community had nicknamed Becky Bristol's Angel and was eager to get justice for her. Nathan and Shauna were tried together with two of their friends who were charged with assisting an offender. The two other friends that had been arrested pled guilty to the assisting and offender charges at an earlier hearing, avoiding the public trial. All four claimed to have no idea that they were moving human remains. Nathan continued to insist that he acted alone without Shauna, and Shauna continued to deny any involvement or knowledge about Becky's murder. Yet her DNA was found on a face mask near Becky's remains in the shed. And on the night of Becky's murder, a search of Shauna's phone revealed a YouTube search for "Do You Want to Hide a Body?", a takeoff of the song "Do You Want to Build a Snowman?" from the Disney film Frozen. The next morning, Nathan admitted to manslaughter, not murder. This was done so that the jury would have to consider that as an option as they made their verdict. Thankfully, it did not help him. The trial lasted almost a month, and after 3 hours and 27 minutes of deliberation, the verdicts were in. The two friends who were on trial were both cleared of all charges, but Nathan was convicted of murder and Shauna of manslaughter. They were also both convicted of conspiracy to kidnap, perverting the course of justice, preventing the lawful burial of a body, and possession of two stun guns. 2 days later, the judge referred to the kidnapping and murder as, quote, sexually motivated, and sentenced Nathan to life in prison with a minimum of 33 years, and Shauna to 17 years. 2 years after he was in prison, Nathan was attacked in jail by a fellow inmate who poured a jug of scalding hot butter on his head and neck. Nathan spent time in the hospital after and is reported to have suffered severe burns. Shauna, however, fared much better. She was released on probation on September 1st of last year, after having served only 8 years in prison. Unbelievable. Bristol's angel is gone, and one of the devils that murdered her is free. From Wondery and Treefort Media, this is Killer Psyche. I'm your host, Candace DeLong. This episode was written and produced by Lisa Ammerman and Julie Burke. Ann Liu is our producer, and Jada Williams is our associate producer. Story research and additional writings by Ann Liu, Will Christensen, and Jada Williams. Mix and sound design by Matt Dyson, Abigail Sullivan, and Aaron Bauman. Head of audio, Tom Monahan, with audio assistance from Masuzu Enaga. For Wondery, Stephanie Wachneen and Claire Chambers are producers, and Callum Plews is senior managing producer. The executive in charge of production for Treefort is Oscar Guido, and the co-executive producer is Julie Burke. Lastly, our executive producers are Kelly Garner and Lisa Ammerman for Treefort, and Marsha Louie, Morgan Jones, and Aaron O'Flaherty for Wondery. And last but not least, myself, Candace DeLong. The series is produced by Wondery and Treefort Media.
This is the emergency broadcast system. A ballistic missile threat has been detected inbound to your area.
Your phone buzzes and you look down to find this alert. What do you do next? Maybe you're at the grocery store, or maybe you're with your secret lover, or maybe you're robbing a bank. Based on the real-life false alarm that terrified Hawaii in 2018, Incoming, a brand new fiction podcast exclusively on Wondery Plus, follows the journey of a variety of characters as they confront the unimaginable. The missiles are coming. What am I supposed to do? Featuring incredible performances from Tracy Letts, Mary Lou Henner, Mary Elizabeth Ellis, Paul Edelstein, and many, many more, Incoming is a hilariously thrilling podcast that will leave you wondering, how would you spend your last few minutes on Earth? You can binge Incoming exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify.